and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. Today I speak with Dr. William Glenn Robertson, who's written an extensive book on the Chickamauga campaign of the U.S. Civil War. Well, thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Dr. William Glenn Robertson, author of River of Death, The Chickamauga Campaign, Volume 1, The Fall of Chattanooga. Thank you for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure, Chris.
So first, tell me, how did you get into studying and writing history?
I was born into a family that was always historically minded. One branch of it descending from John Johnson, an ancient planter at Jamestown, Virginia, in about 1611. I was born at the end of World War II, and my young childhood was the Korean War. And as I grew up with an affinity for military toys and military books, history books, as a Southerner, I was interested in the Civil War in Virginia. And I recall as a young child, I was shown a map of Virginia that marked the Civil War battles with cross sabers. Mm-hmm. And there was a cross saber down near where I lived in Isle of Wight County, and that started me into investigating the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I was 60 miles south of Petersburg, Virginia, and so that was my first interest when I discovered there was a very small battle known to the Federals as the Battle of Deserted House near where I lived in an adjacent county. I had my mother take me to a local library, and there we found both the official records, Volume 18, and the Civil War Atlas to accompany the records. And there were maps of this little fight and lots of maps of Petersburg, and so I really got into that. In high school, I founded a Civil War roundtable, and we raised enough money to go to the great reenactment of Bull Run in 1961 as a group.
Mm-hmm.
I then went to the University of Richmond. I did a senior thesis on the Civil War in Western Tidewater, Virginia. Went to the University of Virginia, where I took a master's degree and eventually a PhD. Both the master's degree and the doctorate resulted in manuscripts that were subsequently published.
Mm-hmm.
The master's degree was The Battle of Old Men and Young Boys, the first battle for Petersburg, originally published 1989, reissued in 2015 by Savas Beatty.
Mm-hmm.
The doctorate, Backdoor to Richmond on the Bermuda Hundred Campaign, published originally in 1987, and due to be published, republished next year, also by Savas Beatty.
Mm-hmm.
I then spent 10 years in academia at a variety of institutions in Virginia, New Mexico, and Colorado, where I taught wherever the curriculum permitted. Mm-hmm. Military history. And in 1981, I went to, took a job here at the Command and General Staff College for the Army here in Leavenworth, Kansas, and that got me into doing something called the Staff Ride, which we can go into as you wish, but that's what led me to Chickamauga eventually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, at this point, I guess I'd like to talk about the book itself. Tell me about it.
What I wanted to do when I decided to write a book on Chickamauga was to use the materials that I had gathered here at the Staff College for the Chickamauga Staff Ride course.
Mm-hmm.
Write a comprehensive and, as near as I could, all-inclusive book on the campaign as well as the battle of Chickamauga. The current volume is the first of two. It covers the period from 4 July 1863, the end of the Tullahoma campaign, to 9 September which was federal occupation of Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
The second volume will take the story through the Confederate counterstrokes and the large battle of Chickamauga, and culminate most likely with the relief of William Rosecrans in mid-October 1863.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to not just tell the high command side of the story, or just the soldier life side of the story. I wanted to make it comprehensive and cover all of that. I wanted to tell both sides as equally as I could, without prejudice either way. That's tougher with the Confederate side because of the scarcity of some resources. But I wanted to make it as balanced as I could. The campaign will cover probably three quarters of the two volumes, and the battle will take up the rest.
Okay. How did you divide up the book? You know, is it chronological? Is it sort of subject by subject, or how does it go?
This is, I write narrative history. I guess you might say I tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be in chronological order. It's going to, within a certain time period, say in a chapter, it will, once the narrative starts moving forward after the introductory chapters where I describe the armies and the personalities, when it becomes chronological, I try to cover what's happening with both sides in a given period. Some chapters will cover a month. Some chapters will cover 2 or 3 days. Some chapters will cover 1 day.
So, apart from sort of a history of the campaign, do you feel like it's revolved around any sort of theme? Something different from what's been done before or anything like that?
Yes. My 30 years actually spent teaching at the Army Staff College showed me a great deal about military affairs that are both timeless over the centuries and often not covered very well by historians. And so I had a number of themes that I wanted to bring out and weave them in threads throughout the chronological narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I can identify probably about at least 6 themes that, if you'd like, I could list them, or we can move on in another direction.
No, I'd like you to list the themes and discuss those. That would be great.
Okay. Number one is the role of personality among senior leaders for the most part. How did William Rosecrans get along with his corps commanders? How did the corps commanders get along with their division commanders? And on down the chain. Because the personalities of people make a great deal of difference in how they interact.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that so much working for the Army and being the command historian for senior leaders like, for instance, David Petraeus when he was here at Leavenworth.
Mm-hmm.
And I see how the personalities affected the decisions that were made and how subordinates reacted. And so that will be, for both the Confederates and the Federals, one of the major themes in the book.
Mm-hmm.
A second theme would be the effect of terrain and the mapping of it done by both sides. This campaign, for my money, is probably covering the most difficult terrain in the American Civil War for major armies.
Mm-hmm.
Grant had the Mississippi River to support him with the Navy. The distances in the Virginia Theater were minuscule compared with what's being dealt with out in the middle part of the country. And the mountain ranges of the Appalachian chain, the Cumberland Plateau, Sand Mountain, Lookout Mountain, and ultimately Missionary Ridge, all of those had to be traversed in this campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The mountains are roughly 1,000 to 1,200 feet above the valleys, and they were in a countryside that was essentially undeveloped. It had only been taken from the Cherokees 30 years when this campaign occurred. So getting over the mountains, and if you've never seen them, and you drive over them as I did so many times, you wonder how they were able to move thousands of troops and thousands of wagons up these mountains. The maps that assisted the commanders are quite interesting in and of themselves. The Confederate ones vary widely. The Army in Cumberland, Rosecrans Army, however, had a major mapping operation of topographical engineers, and they developed a system by a man named William Marginat, one of the engineers, where they would create a map, and they would have a mobile printing press that would travel along, and they would print these maps, and if there was an area they didn't know about what was in it, they would put question marks on the map itself and say, send us information as you move into this area. Now, these maps weren't perfect, but they are really good in helping you to figure out what they were, what they knew and what they were saying when they write an order or a message and they represent a place or a terrain feature. And sometimes they are utterly wrong, but it's the way the maps show things. The chief of staff of the Army of the Cumberland, James Garfield, I found to be especially not very good at understanding what the maps were showing him or having any idea of the spatial relationships. So the terrain itself is a second theme.
Yeah. I was going to mention that, yeah, every time I go to the Shenandoah Mountains, I can't help but think back to, thousands of men and, as you say, wagons and just cannon being moved through there. And I know they tried to use gaps in low ground when possible, but then you think about, you know, if it were rainy or cold and just muddy, and it's just amazing to think about people trying to move and campaign through that kind of area.
To give you a brief example of a personal experience, when I built the Army staff ride to Chickamauga, my associates and I took rental cars down to that area, and we tried to, wherever we could, follow the original tracks up the mountains. And in the early 1980s, you could still take a passenger vehicle, a rental sedan, up the route of the Alex McCook 20th Corps over mountain from the Tennessee River Valley. And we ended up breaking a spring or something. We tore up the rental car. And in more recent years, the road has gone back to nature. And it doesn't even exist anymore. And it was bad in the 1980s. What must it have been in 1863? So terrain is a critical part of the campaign phase.
Yeah.
So, to resume the themes.
Yes.
Third one would be the role of scouts and spies for both sides. There is in the National Archives a manuscript called Summaries of the News Reaching General Rosecrans Headquarters during this campaign. It's sort of like an intelligence journal created by a Captain David Swaim, S-W-A-I-M, who worked for Garfield, and as it turns out, was with Garfield when he died in after his assassination. In the 1880s, so he was a Garfield man from the beginning. But anyway, Swaim kept this sort of diary, and whenever Rosecrans or the Army would get some information, they would write it down. Now, he didn't keep it perfectly, and sometimes the dates get skewed a little bit, but within that, you can learn who did various scouting activities, and I've been able to identify some of those people, including a father and son team in Chattanooga who were reporting from behind the Confederate lines on what was going on the railroads around Chattanooga and the city itself. Hmm. And I've never seen any other book that's addressed those two people. Hmm. And you can learn that from this intelligence journal. On the Confederate side, there is a very brief and hard to decipher Confederate scout book at what used to be the Museum of the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. And that, for a few days, gives a good idea of the Confederates, what they were learning as they were interacting with the Federals advancing. Mm-hmm. So these scouts and spies played a much greater role than is heretofore been identified in books about the campaign.
Hmm.
Going on to theme number four, the role of logistics. To sustain armies of 60,000 people, enormous work has to be done feeding them, feeding their horses, keeping the horses and mules shod. All of this has to happen before you can get to a battle.
Mm-hmm.
And most logisticians do not tell their own story. So you have to pick out bits and pieces, and everywhere that I can, I try to emphasize the movement of supplies, either by railroad or by wagon, or things like, for the Confederates who didn't have prepackaged rations in any form, they spend an enormous amount of time cooking rations. They will slaughter beef and on the spot, either everybody will do it individually or in some units, that would be designated cooks. And they would spend all day cooking up meat and then distribute it out to the soldiers. And they would go 2 or 3 days and then they'd have to stop and cook meat again. And that's a function that's addressed a lot in soldier diaries, but not a lot in history books.
So let me ask you briefly then, I guess, did the South lack sort of the manufacturing process to make prepackaged rations, or, you know, what was the reason for that disparity?
Well, actually, both sides used slaughtered beef, but the North had a better manufacturing of the hard crackers, or hard tack.
Mm-hmm.
That would come prepackaged, made in the North, and be boxed up. And I don't see much of that happening in the South. They were just trying to grind corn into flour and wheat into flour, and as they found grist mills, and then they would just cook it up together. So the North had more prepackaged hardtack, it would appear, in this campaign than the South did. But both sides carried beef cattle with them. And you can imagine trying to move a herd of cattle across a swinging pontoon bridge 1,200 feet long over the Tennessee River.
Hmm.
Very, very difficult to do for the Federals, and I've got soldiers who talk about that. They end up just swimming them across.
Yeah.
The fifth theme I try to address periodically as it becomes relevant is the role of staffs. The mostly younger men who wrote down the orders, copied the orders, sent the orders out to the field. When occasionally they were asked their opinion, they would advise their principal commanders. Sometimes they would get things garbled. Sometimes they would not report what they were supposed to report. And occasionally that would have consequences. And so I try to, wherever I can, highlight these people, who they are, what they're trying to do, how they're trying to manage things for their respective commander.
Mm-hmm.
And for both armies, I have sections that identify the principal staff officers of both Bragg and Rosecrans, and whatever little biographical information I can provide for them.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were young. Some of them had political connections to their boss. Some of them had family connections to their boss, like General Polk, sons and sons-in-law and nephews and such. And some of these people did a great job, and some of them didn't do so well.
Mm-hmm.
That will continue to be a theme in Volume 2 when we get to the battle.
So, if I can briefly mention, sure. it's kind of interesting to see to the extent to which the Civil War was almost a conflict between families and, family groups and sort of people fighting, maybe not so much for politics, but because they were part of one group or another that chose one side or another, if that makes sense. And especially like in local areas, one family might not like another, so they're fighting on different sides for that reason and maybe not politics.
There is a section of North Georgia that features very heavily in Volume 2 called Macklemore's Cove. It's east of Lookout Mountain, and it's a little V-shaped valley that is made by a lookout and a spur called Pigeon Mountain. And it'll be a place where Bragg is going to try to trap part of the Federal Army. The point I want to make in regard to what you just said is that most of the people who lived in that valley seem to have been pro-Union. And even though they would hold two or three slaves, surprisingly, they were pro-Union and very, very helpful to the Federal Army units that came into that area. I found numerous occasions of that, and I've looked up the folks in the census of 1860, and I found that there was this tendency among these people who lived in the Morse Cove. Now, if you go east of Pigeon Mountain, out into the wider, flatter area where the town of Lafayette, or Lafayette as we might say, but they call it Lafayette,
mm-hmm.
They were pro-Southern. And even today, in my 25 years of running tours down there, you talk to local people, and they say, those people over in the Cove are different, even today, from us. I mean, we don't get along with them.
Mm.
And so, you do have these little pockets of, say, pro-unionism, even though some of these people are slaveholders.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to go, some people could follow their economic interests, some people follow their political interests, some people follow their family ties. Thomas Crittenden, commanding the 21st Corps in the Army of the Cumberland, had a brother, George, who was a Confederate general for a while until he was cashiered for drunkenness.
Hmm.
So, and both came from Kentucky and were the sons of the late Senator, famous John Crittenden.
Mm-hmm.
So, you get all sorts of family interactions. George Thomas, the best corps commander in the Union Army of the Cumberland, was a Virginian from very near to where I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
And his family disowned him when he stayed with the Union.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it is indeed a civil war.
Yeah. And when it comes to local differences, that always makes me wonder how it feeds into the sort of the intelligence theme that you mentioned, how you get your information.
There is a family that lived in the Cove by the name of Gower. G-O-W-E-R is the way some people spell it. And I looked up Mr. Gower, and he had a son in the Union Army.
Hmm.
And he became a source of information for the Confederates maneuvering in the Cove against the Union Army.
Huh.
And the information he provides is not helpful to the Confederates. He multiplies the number of federal troops they're facing far beyond reason, and so he's providing disinformation to the Confederates operating in the area.
Hmm.
And they don't seem to be aware of that. And so the campaign goes in a certain direction, partially because of the disinformation that Mr. Gower provided.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Once you drill down into the very sharp details of things, you start finding all these little interconnections that if you're writing at the 30,000-foot level, you don't even know exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that comes at a cost, and eventually we can get into, you know, that. But the whole purpose of my study is to illuminate some of these deep, dark recesses that other people have just glossed over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe I'm successful, maybe I'm not, but that's what's been my purpose. I do want to get into the final theme very quickly, and then we can move on to other things.
Yes.
And that is the role of new technology for this time of American history. It would be the railroad and the telegraph. The railroad, the Army of Cumberland was totally dependent on a single-track railroad stretching from the Tennessee River all the way back through Nashville to Louisville, Kentucky. They didn't have a river to help them out. They had crossed the river, but the river at Muscle Shoals could not sustain steamboats, so they couldn't use anything but wagon haul and railroads. And it was a single track, first the Louisville and Nashville Railroad between those two cities, and then the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad all the way down into Chattanooga. Bragg, on the other hand, for the Confederates, had to depend on the Western and Atlantic Railroad to Atlanta. Once he lost his contact with Knoxville when Burnside's Army of the Ohio severed the line running to Bristol, Virginia, and then ultimately to Richmond. So railroads were critical to both armies in this campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not in good shape because they were southern railroads and they'd not been well capitalized. And they wore out very, very quickly. So you get all sorts of potential train wrecks, and in fact, on the night of the 13th of September, which is beyond Volume 1, there will be a massive head-on collision between a troop train and a empty supply train, north of, near Cartersville, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that will affect the movements. Whenever the railroads are interdicted in any way, then people start running out of food, running out of forage, things like that.
Mm.
And it becomes a driver for how the campaign goes. When the Confederates think that the Union is going to move north of Chattanooga, if you think logistically, they can't, because they can't sustain themselves in the barren area of the Cumberland Plateau. They have to follow the railroad. And the railroad comes to the Tennessee River Valley at Stevenson, Alabama, south of Chattanooga, and crosses the river at Bridgeport, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think logistically, the Army of the Cumberland almost has to follow the railroad. And this is a fascinating study of how commanders who are trying to adapt the technology that is only 30 years old,
mm-hmm.
think of us trying to deal with, say, computers. 30, 40 years old. It takes some adaptation. So railroad is new technology, and some people are good with it, and some people are not. Rosecrans had a steam car that was a combination passenger car and locomotive called a steam dummy. They were built, I forget now exactly where they were built. I think it was in Ohio. So they were built for city street running for railroads because they were thought not to frighten horses so much.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Rosecrans, army took over three of these, and he uses them as a personal transport to run up and down from Bridgeport back to Stevenson, before they cross the, Cumberland Plateau up to Nashville. So he uses it as a command vehicle for a while. And that's a technology that was by no means available prior to that time. And he adapts it perfectly. As far as the telegraph goes, the federal army both uses the infrastructure that exists, the landlines, and also has field telegraph trains that can string wire using something called the Beardsley telegraph. and connect that to the landlines. So as Rosecrans' army advances across the river into territory that's not, had not been theirs, they will rebuild the telegraph line. In fact, they will string a waterproof cable telegraph line under the Tennessee River at Bridgeport, and then tap back into the railroad telegraph that goes over to Chattanooga. And then south of Chattanooga, they string these, by stringing wire out of the back of wagons, they follow the army for a while into the mountains south of Chattanooga. And by that means, Rosecrans can be in touch with Washington, D.C. within a matter of a few short hours. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately for them, all they can provide is good wishes at that stage of the day, because you can't move people that quickly. But the telegraph makes a world of difference for both armies, actually.
So, in a sense, some of the stuff you say brings to mind maybe a generalization on my part, but, you know, nowadays I think people are sort of expectant and familiar with the country being ready for natural disaster and war. We have things pre-positioned. We have highway systems that are designed to move, you know, military vehicles can use them. You know, it feels like everything nowadays is prepared for disaster. Whereas back during the time of the Civil War, it feels like it was a country that was not designed for war, natural disaster or anything. And it was almost like a war occurred on top of, you know, a bunch of, people unaware that something like this might sweep through their lands, so to speak.
No one in American history had ever had to command armies of the size of Civil War armies. Nor had they ever had to feed and clothe armies of such magnitude. So they were all learning on the fly. The South was ill-prepared with an infrastructure to handle railroads or manufacturing. The North, of course, was far better prepared. But in the campaign that I'm writing about, they are fighting in essentially a frontier environment. Where there are no good roads, there is no valley pike, in other words, down where this is occurring, below Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't any macadamized roads. There aren't any good roads, hardly at all. And the railroads represent a quantum leap forward in their ability to sustain themselves. But once they get away from the railroads, they're dependent solely on army wagons pulled by six mules or sometimes more, being dragged up 1,000-foot grades.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, so even though the United States was, particularly in the North, was industrializing, very little of that had occurred in the area where this campaign takes place. So it's a frontier campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The Federals do encounter a couple of iron foundries that are being put together because of the war emergency in the campaign area, but they are just nascent and aren't even in operation, so what's being built is going to be destroyed by the federal.
Mm-hmm.
The Confederates use caves in this area to mine saltpeter or niter or gunpowder. Federals encounter a number of those caves and destroy those operations, but it's all very much vestigial, you know, compared with, say, what DuPont was doing in Delaware or something like that, or even in Richmond, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a frontier.
I like that term, frontier. I think that kind of says it. It's interesting, yeah. I'd like to turn towards the resources you used to do your research. You mentioned some of what you used. Can you elaborate on what you used for your research?
Certainly. I began, like everybody begins, with the official records, the War of the Rebellion official records of the Union and Confederate Army. Thousands of pages of battle reports, message traffic, intelligence report. That's the foundation. Once you get that foundation established, you start looking around the things that didn't make it into the official records. The National Archives has a number of useful things, many of which are remain untapped when you get into the details of the Inspector General's reports and the Quartermaster reports and all those things. Most people don't work with them, and I've only worked with them a little bit. I did have a student go into that heavily with a master's degree here at the Staff College. But the National Archives does also contain personal papers and the papers of details that didn't make it into the official records. So you have to work in various things at the National Archives, and that's a tough place to work because the stuff is literally coming apart in your hands when you handle it. And I'm not trying to drop a dime on the National Archives folks. They do the best they can in a hard situation. But our paper documents from that era are rapidly deteriorating. Nonetheless, there are useful things. Things like certain diaries, General Thomas's papers, things like that. Once you get beyond that, it's a question of going to the papers of the principals. William Rosecrans papers are at UCLA, California, because he ended up out there in California. Braxton Bragg's papers are in Cleveland, Ohio, at the Western Reserve Historical Society. They are hugely important. When you go beyond that, then you start working through tens, twenties, maybe hundreds of repositories throughout the United States, starting with major university libraries, major state historical societies, eventually ending up with little historical societies in communities scattered throughout the country. And it's just amazing how much there is scattered around the country. I have done everything I can to get as much as I can. Part of the reason why it's taken me so long to do this, but there's still plenty out there. I do have to give kudos to my friend David Powell, who's just published a 3-volume Chickamauga series. Dave and I might differ on some details of the campaign and the battle, but he is an indefatigable researcher. He came here to the Staff College a number of years ago, and we allowed him to copy everything we had gathered up to that point. And in exchange, he has provided me with CDs of all of his research up to the point of his publication. And he has visited far more, either by letter or by going, far more of these local repositories than I've been able to get to. And finally, in terms of places, the National Park Service, Chickamauga, Chattanooga National Military Park, with Jim Ogden as the principal historian, another great benefactor to me. They have gathered so much. I've given them a lot of stuff I found. Dave Powell has given them a lot of stuff. But they get things from people that just walk in and say, I've got great-grandpa's diary. Would you like a copy? And so they have several filing cabinets full of essentially primary source material there at the park. Another force that's almost equally good in certain respects is Stones River National Battlefield. They have all the stuff they have like that. They have digitized and have put online. So you don't have to go to Murfreesboro, although it's pleasant, a place to visit and work. And there are things I found at Kennesaw Mountain National Battlefield. There are odds and ends just all over the country. And I've got right now about over 41,000 note cards.
Wow.
And it's still growing. I estimate by the time I finish, if I live long enough, it'll maybe be 5,000.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how much it's out there. And in fact, say a staff officer's journal that really lets you know who likes who and who doesn't get along with who and what is going on in the internal workings of the headquarters, it's golden.
Mm-hmm.
So the research task, you could just spend forever on it, and I've spent an awful lot of time, but I've gained a lot of insights from doing it.
Mm-hmm. What part of the research was most enjoyable?
Well, it's always like panning for gold. You know, move a lot of earth to get a few nuggets.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say probably the most revealing was the diary of Bragg's Assistant Adjutant General, George Brent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in his Bragg's papers at Western Reserve. It's not listed as being written by George Brent, but a number of years ago, some people pretty well proved that George Brent was the author of it. And that gives you every day an insight into Bragg's thinking and what is being reported at that headquarters. And that is just so useful. That type of thing, similarly, there's a diary that's partially printed in the official records of Lieutenant William Richmond, who was an aide to Leonidas Polk,
mm-hmm.
Bragg Corps Commander. And Richmond is even more open about what's happening at the headquarters at his level than Brent is. Brent is very circumspect. Richmond lets it fly. And surprisingly, the official records people who put it together and printed it expurgated Richmond's diary. Everywhere there is a mention in the original diary of somebody getting drunk or somebody getting into a fight, that is not in the published version in the official records.
Mm-hmm.
But it is in the version that is in General Polk's papers at the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. So those types of things are what I find just fascinating. And there are other soldiers' diaries. There is a published one from the 59th Illinois where a lieutenant comments a lot about his division commander having his wife with him on the campaign, which was against the rules. But Jefferson C. Davis did what he wanted. He's the man that shot Major General Bull Nelson in Louisville, Kentucky in the previous year and got away with murder.
Hmm.
Davis has his wife traveling with him in the campaign, and he doesn't say much about it. Obviously, he doesn't say anything about it, actually, but one of his staff guys mentions it. But the lieutenant's diary, published Lieutenant Chesley Mossman, he comments regularly about some Mrs. Davis and her companion going this way, and the human details are what interest me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been the most enjoyable, finding that, yes, indeed, these are real people, not cardboard cutouts.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they had wants and needs and wishes just like the rest of us.
What did you discover that was most surprising in your research?
A couple of things. First, there is a brigade in the Army of the Cumberland called the Lightning Brigade, commanded by Colonel John Wilder. That regiment, or that brigade of five regiments, has been given a lot of favorable press over the last 2-3 decades. And there are multiple books about the Lightning Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
Their reputation, in my opinion, far exceeds the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Wilder is credited. Wilder was quite an individual. He knew how to bag Colonel Rosecrans by presenting him a blooded stallion that he had captured in Tennessee. He got dispensation to do pretty much whatever he wanted. Wilder's reputation was such in his books, and I won't go into who's written them. People can look up those. One of the authors is recently deceased. The books say that Wilder masterminded the deception operation north of Chattanooga that made the Confederates look north while Rosecrans crossed south of the city. And this deception operation is given an awful lot of print ink by a lot of people. And the Wilder story is he was the only guy there. Sort of like the famous story about Theodore Roosevelt's account of the Spanish-American War, alone in Cuba. In fact, Wilder was alone up there in the Chattanooga Valley. It turns out that, from my research, any of the deception operations of any consequence should be ascribed to Brigadier General William Hazen, who for a time commanded the multiple brigades in the deception operation. And by reading all the diaries of Wilder's command, it's occasionally bombarding the city of Chattanooga, they didn't do much of this deception. The deception involved throwing yourself way upstream, playing music at odd locations, topping up wood being heard across the river and throwing the straps into the river, looked like you were building boats, all that kind of stuff. Wilder gets all the credit, and I just don't see it. So that will upset the Wilder aficionados. the other surprising thing is that, as I read it, Bragg is a much better commander. He knew the cards he had to play. He knew he had an inferior-sized army until he got reinforced. He knew he couldn't hold the river line in that mountainous terrain. He had a plan to deal with that once the Federals crossed. He attempted to put it into play twice, and subordinates failed both times. And if you read most of the standard accounts of the campaign, Bragg is an ignoramus who doesn't, including the biographers of Bragg, except for the most recent one, he is portrayed as somebody over his head, incapable of doing anything, just being totally lost in terms of fighting a campaign. And I don't see that. I see him making a good assessment of the situation, being willing to give up the city temporarily to maneuver against the enemy once the enemy makes himself known. Now, it doesn't work out, and that'll play out in Volume 2, but I see Bragg as a man equally as adept in mounting a campaign or planning a campaign as Rosecrans is. And that will not be the view that you'll find in virtually every book on Chickamauga.
Was there an issue that you researched that was particularly difficult to come to a conclusion on, or maybe you still feel like you haven't, figured it out yet?
There's a little bit in the volume that's not yet done, although I've written the chapters. The McLemore's Cove episode has a lot of things you can't really nail down, and you have to read into the message traffic what actually happens. And I'm finding that it depends on who writes the message, the sequence of messages that affect the operational commander on the ground, T.C. Hindman. And I've discovered that the messages coming from Bragg's headquarters are diametrically opposed to each other. Bragg will write one thing, and his chief of staff, William McCall, will write another. And I'm coming to be able to posit that that's a big part of why the episode goes badly for the Confederate. But that's in volume two.
Okay.
So that won't be in this first volume, but I am finding that I've got a hypothesis, and I'm going to put it out there, that I'd like to have a little more documentation on that.
Was there anything that that you found that emotionally moved you, either something amusing or something that saddened you?
In working with the soldiers' diaries and letters, every now and then you might find something amusing, but more often you find things that are really saddening. I found accounts of people being shot inadvertently by somebody fooling around in camp and dying as a result. I found an account of an ammunition explosion up on a Cumberland Plateau near Pawnee, Tennessee, where a number of Union soldiers are badly burned, and those that survived are disfigured, and those that don't, their campaign ended right there before they ever saw the Confederates.
Mm-hmm.
There will be, in Volume 2, a very sad story of a young man from Illinois who's wounded and lies on the battlefield for 7 calendar days before he gets more than just something to eat. He's immobile. And he's then exchanged, and they first thought that he would survive the amputation of his leg, but it turns out it doesn't work out for him. And he writes the last letter. I used to read it on the battlefield. It would make a stone weep to read that. Anytime you find young people, young soldiers, whose lives, I keep thinking now as I continue on the project, what a tragedy for the country just in terms of the loss of an entire generation almost of young people who could have done so much to make this country greater in the latter half of the 19th century, but they are buried by the destructive war. That's what saddens me the most. These individual stories. There's a guy who has to go back home because his wife and children are swept away and drowned in a flood in Ohio, Pennsylvania, I think. And you think about what he's got to deal with. There are 7 or 8 Union soldiers that drowned crossing the Tennessee River. Many of them just frolicking in the water until they get in over their head. They can't swim, and nobody can save them. There's one man who's trying to move a mule onto a ramp, and the mule kicks him, knocks him out into the water, and he drowns. You think about the fragility of life even before the bullets start flying in a big battle. And one of my reviewers at UNC Press thought I gave too much space to soldier stories. And I had to differ with him because I wasn't writing a 30,000 foot level story. There are individual stories that people need to know about. And that's, unfortunately, most of them are very, very sad stories.
Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published? Or any difficulties in getting it finished, and how you overcame those?
After my Bermuda 100 book came out with the University of Delaware Press, and maybe even after the second one came out, in the late 80s, I approached UNC Press at the annual convention of the Southern Historical Association. And the Chickamauga book to them. And they were kind enough to accept it and give me a contract and a small advance. And then I got embroiled in moving up the chain of management here at the staff college. And my son was born, and life got very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed with me, probably because they had invested a small sum.
Mm-hmm.
But they stayed with me. And eventually, once I retired 7 years ago, I was able to move along more rapidly with it. And so I give the press all kudos for sticking with me.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they thought the original volume was too long, or the reader thought the volume was too long. One of them did.
Mm-hmm.
One reader did, one reader didn't. And so the editor, two editors removed from the one that signed me to the contract, they wanted it cut down. And so I had to take a year to cut it down. I cut 70,000 words from the manuscript. Probably about 20%. Maybe a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, I had to cut out some good things. And that was unfortunate. But in other respects, it tightened up the prose. And so it was beneficial. And shorten the paragraphs, because I tended to write extra long paragraphs.
Hmm, okay.
And so, after I sent the manuscript in a couple years ago, then they wanted it cut down. And so it took another year to do that. And so, it's been a fairly long road to the home, as they say in the South. But it's, I guess now, and it'll be out in a month, or less, or whenever.
Mm-hmm.
This is the final thing that, this interview, final thing that I'm, on the hook to do. I'm not living where I do. I'm not going to be going on any particular book tour or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that would be, productive for either the press or myself. Whoever had to pay for it.
Right.
I have to just speak well of UNC Press for, you know, sticking with me for essentially 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
I am 4 chapters into volume 2, and every day I continue to work more on that as I continue to add a few more sources and note cards. It's been a long process. And in the course of that, I've also revised my 2 earlier books for another publisher. And, so I've been busy as a scholar in my declining years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have. Where your books can be found on Amazon and that sort of thing. Do you happen to also have a website, or I guess you don't do social media or anything, where you, write your thoughts?
I am on Facebook. I mostly lurk there.
Hmm.
I listed on Facebook, and I'm not sure what I would do to, you know, push it there. And the people that I know from back when my childhood days, I don't think they care to read it anyway. But I, you know, they'd be happy to say they knew somebody who was an author, but they're not going to read a big book called Civil War Battle, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
I do not have a website or .com or anything.
Okay. I just wanted to check about that. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts?
I'll say this. In my writing career, I have tried to look dispassionately at a number of Civil War commanders. And in the case of Benjamin Butler, in my book on the Bermuda 100 campaign, Backdoor to Richmond,
mm-hmm.
I found that he was not, in my view, nearly as bad as the common knowledge would have him. a number of years ago, I was asked to do an article by Gary Gallagher on Dan Sickles at Gettysburg and the peach orchard.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about that beyond the general facts of the case. And he said, be controversial, Gary did. Well, the only way I can be controversial is to defend him. Sickles, moving out forward of Cemetery Ridge Line. And when I looked at it, I found there was a case to be made for Sickles. And so I wrote that article that way. In this book, I'm going to provide a more favorable view of Braxton Bragg that will probably make not a ripple in the historiography. Another example, more recently, I was asked to write about the black divisions in the Overland Campaign of 1864,
mm-hmm.
which brought me, of course, to the crater and the destruction of the division. And I essentially defended Ambrose Burnside's role in that debacle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's made, none of those has made a bit of difference because I look for books that come out subsequently to see if they at least acknowledge that I had written.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them don't. Now, one of them on a new book, a reasonably new book on the crater, does mention that what I wrote existed in a chapter in another UNC press called Black Soldiers in Blue.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't take any of my points. So my final thought is I don't expect to change anybody's mind because Civil War historiography is, seems to me, so set in its narrative that no matter how much new information you find or how much new analysis you bring, people still want to hear, as one of my colleagues put it, the same old stories told in the same old way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to have a new interpretation that moves the needle.
Yeah.
As some of my recent colleagues trying to pull back the tide of U.S. Grant hagiography that's welling over us.
Mm-hmm.
They've tried and said, let's take another look at some of these things we thought we knew were true that really aren't. And they're not being received very well either.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't expect to change many minds. What I do want is for people to at least give it a fair hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I can do.
Yeah. It seems that, big changes within a field like history, it takes maybe a generation for people to maybe come around or such. I've seen also that in archaeology as well. Changes move slowly in ways of thinking, so.
It's just like, as I just gave you the quotation from a friend of mine, people really don't want to look at new interpretations, it seems. I mean, the reading public, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
They expect to get a standard story, and they're disappointed if they don't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate. Well, thank you for speaking with me.
It has been my great pleasure.
Thank you. This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H. C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.